What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Eric Myers, one of the leading biblical archaeologists in the world and the head of the Center for Judaic Studies at Duke University. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The holiday of Purim is coming up fast. We'll celebrate it this morning at my own Temple Emmanuel here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, with a fabulous takeoff of the show Les Mizrab called Les Megillab, right after you finish listening to Too Jewish this morning at 10. And of course, the show is free, everybody's welcome, followed by a huge kids' carnival. Anyway, the actual festival of Purim falls next Saturday night and Sunday morning. Purim is the great Jewish holiday of celebration, reversals, silliness, and joy. Purim is also arguably the most enjoyable of all Jewish festivals, the one that features the reading, well, the chanting of the Megillat Esther, the Scroll of Esther from the Bible, with lots of cheering and booing, carnivals, plays, food, drink, fun, and frolic. For kids or adults, there is no more purely pleasant holiday than Purim, coming as it does in the springtime and promising silliness, costumes, and lots of opportunities to celebrate. In that spirit, we're supposed to break out this time of year and really embrace the joy of being Jewish. While most of the year we tend to focus a little too much on other Jewish qualities like responsibility and guilt, at the time of Purim and in its general vicinity, we are commanded, literally commanded, to have a good time. We smile more, tell jokes, plan parties, think up ridiculous costumes to wear, and just generally enjoy life. Purim is a great deal like the other fun spring festivals going around, Mardi Gras, Carnival, Spring Fling, Rodeo, what have you. Only Purim has been around a good deal longer, going back as it does about 2,500 years to ancient Persia. Purim is in that great run of Jewish holidays, from Hanukkah in December to Passover in April, that could be described in 9 words. They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. In Purim's case, it was the evil Haman, counselor to the king of Persia, who had it in for the Jews. But it was two Jews, a man and his niece, Mordechai and Esther, who saved our people. And the food we eat and love is the fabulous Hamantaschen, the pastry of perfection. Now, about that drinking alcohol thing and Purim. While we Jews are not generally known for our drinking, as Jackie Mason says, most of us are looking for another piece of cake, not a martini. The holiday of the Megillah actually requires us legally to drink Ad Delo Yada until we can't tell the difference between Haman the villain and Mordechai the hero. In that spirit, or spirits, there are some classic Purim songs about drinking, including this one from the Sephardic group, The Voice of the Turtle, and their Purim CD called The Sword of the Dove. The song is Quando Haman Semboracho, when Haman was drunk.
Cuando Haman se emborrachó y salió afuera, a los niños preguntó qué peracha era. Dijeron, vayera, labran. Tenemos padre Rahman, que lo sabía, de ya Haman lo mate. Viva yo, viva el rey, viva todo Israel, viva la reina Esther, que tanto placer nos dio. Y salió afuera, a los niños preguntó qué peracha era. Dijeron, vayera, vayera, labram.
tenemos padre Rahman, que el vos sabía de Yahamán lo mate. Viva yo, viva el rey, viva todo Israel, viva la reina Esther, que tanto placer nos dio.
The wild, fun song, Cuando Haman se emborrachó, when Haman was drunk for Purim, coming up next Saturday night and Sunday, or this morning at our carnival in my temple. I have to admit that I flat out love Purim. We rabbis sometimes talk about the fact that Purim is a kind of anti-Yom Kippur, coming exactly half a year later, 6 months nearly to the day, you know, the other side of the year, and reversing all the customs of the abstemious Atonement Day in raucous celebration. On Yom Kippur, we dress in white. On Purim, in bright costumes. On Yom Kippur, we fast. On Purim, we feast. On Yom Kippur, we abstain from drinking even water. On Purim, we drink even alcohol to excess. And so on. Or as one rabbi put it, on Purim, we dress up and pretend to be Gentiles. On Yom Kippur, we dress up and pretend to be Jews. You know, Yom Kippurim? Anyway, in truth, for me, Purim is just proof that even God needs a good party now and then. So enjoy Purim, both today at the shows and carnivals, and next Saturday night and Sunday for the Megillah reading. In the spirit of humor of Purim, and in preparation for our 10th anniversary celebration of this very Two Jewish radio show, Saturday night, March 2nd at the Fox Theater, get your tickets now at foxtheatertucson.org, we are previewing our star comedian that night, Robert Klein. This is a great take from some of his early humor.
I carried the New York City flag in the assembly. And PS-94, that's the blue flag there, you may remember, the emblem on it of the white man jipping the Indian. When you're holding that heavy flag, you know, at the risk of dropping it, everything seems extra long. Some illiterate kid used to read the psalm. You're not allowed to do that anymore. I think they cut it out because it was boring. I don't think there were any religious things involved. You know. They just chose illiterates to read the psalm, being prompted by a teacher. Lord is my shepherd. Shepherd, shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me light. And everyone's going, including God. Let's go with him. A little earthquake to cause in Argentina in 20 minutes. I remember once the kid who carried the American flag dropped it by accident. He tripped. I assume it was an accident. Who knows? Maybe a communist stuck his foot out. You know. Tripped him. Yeah, they do that. You know, they send their kids and they go into the thing, trip them, yay, mao. They give the signal. And they give the special communist handshake. But the kid dropped the American flag, and it blew his mind because they imbued the flag with a special power beyond itself, like, you know, who knows? He started to bend down and kiss the little gold fringes on the side, those little titsis things, you know. And so, under the approving eye of an adult teacher, that's it, kiss the broadcloth. Very nice. You know. Give it a nice kiss, that'll make everything all better, you know. Children fantasize, something like George Washington's gonna pop out. Hey, you'll drop me! After all I suffered at Valley Forge, you little Jew boy!
That was comedian Robert Klein, who will be here for the 10th anniversary celebration of Two Jewish at the Fox Theater just a couple of weeks from now. Come join us. Go to foxtheatertucson.org, T-H-E-A-T-R-E, or call the Fox box office at 520-547-3040. That's 547-3040. When we come back on Two Jewish this morning, Professor Eric Myers of Duke University, the great archaeologist and writer, will explain what makes Sepphoris Tzipori one of the great archaeological sites in the whole world, and what it means for how we Jews relate to the societies in which we live. Find out in a few moments on Two Jewish.
There's nothing like a live radio show to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Two Jewish Radio Show, presented by the Jim Click Automotive Team at the Fox on March 2nd.
Better than Prairie Home Companion, it's Deli Home Companion. Join me and my great guests, including legendary comedian Robert Klein, for a live radio variety show March 2nd at the Fox to benefit Jewish Family and Children's Services, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and Temple Emmanuel.
Tickets at the Fox Box Office and FoxTucsonTheater.org.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Eric Myers, Duke University. He is one of the most distinguished biblical archaeologists in the world. I don't want to say the most. You know, I don't know if there's arm wrestling matches for this or how you figure it out. Excavator of a number of important sites. Welcome. Good morning.
Wonderful to be here.
My favorite site, certainly one of my favorite sites in all of Israel, maybe in all the world, is the excavation at Sepphoris Tzipori in the north. It is not adequately appreciated internationally, and let's talk a little bit about, first of all, how important it is, and also why people don't get it.
Certainly in Israel, I think Tzipori Sepphoris is one of the most visited sites by internal tourists. School children and lots of kibbutzniks, all sorts of Israelis go there on a regular basis, and it is a central destination on all of domestic tourism in Israel. A little less so for external tourism, but I think it's mosaics and its central importance for both Jewish and early rabbinic history are making it one of the most important sites in Israel, in Israeli archaeology. Let me begin with the famed presence there of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabbi Judah the Patriarch, who lived there at the end of the second, early part of the third century, when the Mishnah, under his leadership, was edited, promulgated, and produced there, and was a great center of Jewish learning. In the first century of the Common Era, it was also the capital of Galilee, and being so close to Nazareth, only about 4 kilometers as a crow flies, it became a central city in the discussion about the nature of the background of Jesus, the degree to which he was Hellenized, the degree to which he participated in the growth of the Galilee region in the time of Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, who made Sepphoris, Tzipori, the ornament of all Galilee. He went on also to establish Tiberias, 18 miles away, as one of the great cities of Galilee. And so Sepphoris, in the time of Antipas, in the lifetime of Jesus, becomes a major urban center in which Jews are settling and in which Jews resettle after the two wars with Rome. And by the time Rabbi Judah is there, well, it is just the major city in the north of Israel, and its mosaics, especially the mansion of Dionysus, possibly the home of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, has all of these gorgeous mosaics, including the famed Mona Lisa of the Galilee. And this has raised the whole issue of the degree to which Rabbi Yehuda himself, early Jews in the rabbinic period, were Hellenized, knowledgeable of Greek, and why they were so tolerant of Greek mythological scenes and data.
And we will talk about that and what that might mean even today for the way that Jews interact with the outside world when we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com, that's T-O-O, Jewish Radio at Yahoo, or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows, streaming them from the website, or download them at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And don't forget, 10th anniversary of Two Jewish, Saturday night, March 2nd at the Fox, starring comedian Robert Klein. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Recently had a visitor who explored questions and really interesting insights into the ultra-Orthodox world. Maybe you can share some of those with us.
Yeah, we had a visitor. His name is Gil Cohen Magin. Gil is a photographer. He used to be working for Reuters. He was one of their famous photographers for Israel and also worldwide on some occasions. He won some prizes and stuff like that. But about 11 years ago, he started looking into the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. But when I'm saying ultra-Orthodox, he was looking into the most extreme and non-Zionistic ultra-Orthodox communities in Israel, namely, mainly the what is called the Bet Aaron or Bes Aaron, which are...
The House of Aaron.
The House of Aaron. They're a very closed and observant and strict community in the ultra-Orthodox population.
Which, when you think about it, extremely strict within ultra-Orthodoxy. So really the most medakdek, the most specific of the specific.
Yeah, definitely. And they're a community that's very hard to engage with. And he became passionate about looking into their community, although he is secular. He shared with us that normally when Reuters or other news magazines would send him to take photos, they would look for the, you know, for the bad stuff, the things that you can show on the paper. When he came there to do his own study, he was looking for the positive stuff to take photos of, the cultural elements, the tradition, the interesting way of looking at them. And that was a big surprise for them. And that's basically what opened the doors for him. He started by engaging with teenagers who start hearing from him about photography and photos, you know, that they don't have photography within their communities. And those teenagers gave him instructions, basically, how to look more ultra-Orthodox so he can come into their events. And he would come with his camera, and it was very complicated, but eventually was able to take photos of some of the most rare ceremonies, including, for example, a ceremony called Peter Chamor, the renovation or reduction or, I don't know, the celebration of a newborn donkey.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I mean, Chamor is not always a positive term in Israel either.
Right. So that, you know, and that celebration is done only when a male donkey is born for the first time from a female donkey, and the owner is an observant Jew, and basically an ultra-Orthodox Jew.
Right.
Which makes it very rare, because most of the ultra-Orthodox are not farmers. They don't grow donkeys. And today it's something extremely rare. And historically, in the you know, in the times of the Bible,
in the Talmudic times, I'm sure it was a more common experience.
So you were supposed to bring that first donkey as a present to the priest in the temple in Jerusalem.
Right.
Now that there is no temple, you need to buy the donkey back.
So it's like Pidyon HaBen, the redemption of the firstborn for boys, except you have to do it for the donkey.
For the donkey. And that was unbelievable. He took photos of this ceremony with thousands of people around. Thousands.
Holy cow. I guess holy donkey, not holy cow. Fascinating. You know what? Let's continue this, because it's such an interesting insight into a world that I don't think our listeners are particularly familiar with. I'm not particularly familiar with, and I've been around the Jewish world a little bit. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week we talked kind of globally about the distinction between Jews in Israel, Jews in the diaspora, in contemporary times, but that bifurcation begins a very long time ago. And the concept of whether it's better for all the Jews to live in Israel, or whether it's richer actually for people who live in the diaspora, or what's not that anybody's giving up Israel so we can emphasize the diaspora, but let's go over this historically a little bit.
Right. So historically, the foundation of our notion that Israel is the promised land is the series of conversations between God and Abraham, and then God and Isaac, and God and Jacob about the covenant. And, you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, I will make of you a great nation, and I'm giving you this land to be yours. But wherever you are in the world, you will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So it wasn't just about a state, it was about a civilization, sort of created simultaneously at Sinai with the revelation of the covenant to the whole Jewish people. And there is a midrash that says that every Jew, including those who are alive today, their soul was present at Mount Sinai, and they were bound by the same covenant. So if we look historically, so Jews were enslaved in the land of Egypt for X hundred years, and they didn't have a country of their own, and they didn't really have a national consciousness. They were a group of slaves who had a common language and maybe some common folklore, possibly, but nothing other than their descent from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob tied them together. Then they have this transformative experience at Mount Sinai, and they are given instructions for what to do when they get to Israel and set up their own country. And of course, it takes them 40 years to go 40 miles because the slave mentality had to die out and they had to be ready to be a free people and masters of their own destiny. But they weren't such masters because they were given very detailed instructions for the temple and the sacrifices and the ark and all kinds of other things that became the focus of this new nation's life. And of course, as the Jewish people had a nasty habit of throughout history, they disappointed God. They didn't hold up their end of the covenant. They became lazy and corrupt and unobservant. And the way that most theories of Jewish history go and Jewish understanding of divine justice and how history plays out is that for our sins, we were exiled from our land. And the temple was destroyed.
Galinu me'aretzenu.
Exactly. Right. So the first temple is destroyed in 586 BCE, and the Jews go into exile in countries to the east, from which some of them never leave. So these ancient Jewish communities in Iraq and Iran date back really to the 6th century BC, long before there was a Greek empire or Roman empire or anything else. But some over the next 200 or 300 years drifted back to Israel and created a so-called second commonwealth. They rebuilt the temple. And they reestablished the temple cult. And another series of problems arose when they created the Second Commonwealth and the Second Temple. And again, it looks like we're going to have to continue this next week. But that first period of exile was not without its pluses, because most of the great books of the prophets were written during that period. And a lot of, like, by the rivers of Babylon, I sat down and wept. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, blah, blah, blah. All of that literature and that sensitivity dates from the first exile, which also contributed richly to Jewish history, culture, and civilization.
Absolutely. And, it's fascinating to see some of these influences woven into Jewish tradition. We think they're natively Jewish. They probably weren't, but certainly they are now. We will talk, we'll continue this theme next week. Thanks, Tom. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. In the spirit of Purim, but also for the coming of Rodeo Weekend in Tucson this coming week, this particular joke. One day, a gorgeous woman gets on the bus, clearly distraught, and sits down next to a guy. She's visibly upset and finally can contain herself no longer. She turns to the guy and says, "I just saw my therapist. He says I have a big problem." "What's the problem?" the guy asks. And she says, "I can't tell you. I don't even know you." So the guy says, "Well, sometimes it's good to tell your problems to a perfect stranger on a bus." And the girl says, "Well, my therapist just told me I'm a nymphomaniac and I only like Jewish cowboys." "By the way, now that I know you, my name is Susan." And the guy says, "Hello, Susan. My name is Bucky Goldstein." Yes, that was the old Jewish Joke of the Week special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy Purim and enjoy rodeo. And now a word of Torah. This week we observe Shabbat Zachor, the Sabbath of Remembrance in Jewish tradition that falls just before Purim. By custom, after reading our weekly Torah portion of Titzaveh from Exodus, which includes the commandment to have a ner tamid, an eternal light, we add a short section of text that recalls the attack by the enemy nation Amalek on our Israelite stragglers as we escaped Egypt during the Exodus. This attack, considered both vicious and cowardly by all commentators, is memorialized each year on the Shabbat, the Sabbath, prior to the holiday of Purim. The Maftir section, this short little section, both begins and ends with words of memory. Zachor et asher asah lecha Amalek. It starts, "Remember what Amalek did to you," and concludes with the powerful statement, "Timche et zecher Amalek mitachat hashamayim. Al tishkach." Obliterate the memory of Amalek under heaven. Do not forget. We always read this section before Purim, which commemorates the great salvation of the Jews of Iran in Mordechai and Esther's time, maybe 2,500 years ago, because Haman, the villain of the Purim story, is supposed to be a descendant of the Amalekites. By a variety of other Jewish traditions, all deep enemies of Judaism are linked to Amalek and Haman. including in some peculiar readings Torquemada and even Hitler, who actually outlawed Purim in Nazi Germany, and I suppose Muhammad Ahmadinejad. There are many curious customs associated with this mitzvah, the very specific commandment issued in Deuteronomy to obliterate Amalek. Some Jewish communities on Purim actually write the name of Amalek on their shoes and then rub it off on the floor during the Megillah reading. A traditional sofer, a Torah scribe, will begin to write a new Torah by inscribing the word Amalek on a piece of parchment and then crossing it out, blotting it out, as it were. And since Haman was an Agagite, descended from the king of the Amalekites, the whole custom of groggers and noisemaking to blot out Haman's name comes from that same commandment. All of which raises a very good question. Amalek was a minor people, more a tribe than a nation. As a distinct political or ethnic entity, it has long disappeared. In fact, if we really wanted to obliterate Amalek's name from under heaven, the easiest way would be for us Jews to stop talking about it. Nobody else would ever mention it again. Poof, Amalek gone, blotted out. And yet, instead, we read this passage twice yearly in every synagogue in the world. Once in Deuteronomy during the regular Torah reading cycle, and once just before Purim on this Shabbat Zachor. Why the elaborate need to remember a truly ancient wrong done to us? Psychoanalysts could say that the profound emotional injury perpetrated on our people at the very moment of redemption, we after all had just gotten out of Egypt after 400 years of slavery, was so painful that we Jews have never really gotten over it. The catharsis of remembering and overcoming Amalek each and every year helps us to move to a healthier, more holistically complete place. We remember so that we can overcome. Political scientists would look at this remembering differently. They might suggest that the military and organizational weakness that allowed the straggling that Amalek took advantage of must be remembered so we can avoid falling into that kind of trap again. Organization, preparation, a proper plan for functioning are all essential to being a real nation like Israel is today. Moral experts, like those who learn and teach Musar, might even see this paradoxical need as a kind of Davka experience. The commandment to exterminate actually forces us to remember our failings. Thus, we can never become too confident of our own prowess or foresight, and so must remain humble. But we simple Jews can look at this, well, more simply. Remembering might be the primary Jewish act above all. We are commanded using the same exact Hebrew word, zachor, to remember Shabbat, an unalloyed good, just as Amalek is considered an unadulterated evil. Our existence as intelligent, informed, thoughtful people, as true Jews, is contingent on our ability to truly learn to do Torah. In order to do that well, we must exercise our memories vigorously and completely. In remembering both the good and bad, we are achieving the highest level of serving B'Tselem Elohim as imitators of God. By remembering, we can learn. Or in Nachman of Bratslav's version, we can be redeemed. In remembering, we can learn how to act now, in the future, and for the future. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll talk with our guest, Professor Eric Myers, the director of the Center for Jewish Studies at Duke University, a great archaeologist and the excavator of the phenomenal site of Sepphoris Tzipori in the Galilee. Find out why it's so relevant for us today when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project.
Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
There's nothing like a live radio show to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Two Jewish Radio Show, presented by the Jim Click Automotive Team at the Fox on March 2nd.
Better than Prairie Home Companion, it's Deli Home Companion. Join me and my great guests, including legendary comedian Robert Klein, for a live radio variety show March 2nd at the Fox to benefit Jewish Family and Children's Services, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and Temple Emmanuel.
Tickets at the Fox box office and foxtucsontheater.org.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Barack Obama pledged to keep Iran from obtaining a nuclear bomb and to stand steadfast with Israel in his State of the Union speech last week. The leaders of Iran must recognize that now is the time for a diplomatic solution because a coalition stands united in demanding that they meet their obligations, and we will do what is necessary to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon, Obama said. He also said he'd continue to back democratization throughout the Middle East. And we will stand steadfast with Israel in pursuit of security and a lasting peace, he added. These are the messages I will deliver when I travel to the Middle East next month. The president's visit to Israel, his first since he was elected president in 2008, will take place over 2 days, March 20th to the 22nd. And several components were announced as well last week. President Obama will speak directly to the Israeli public at a gathering in Jerusalem, be received at a variety of receptions, as well as meeting privately a couple of times with Prime Minister Netanyahu. He will also visit Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial, and Mount Herzl, Israel's National Cemetery. There are still a variety of arrangements to be made, including an actual visit to Tel Aviv. Obama will also travel to Ramallah in the West Bank to meet with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, then return to Jerusalem to see the Dead Sea Scrolls and visit an exhibit at the Israel Museum highlighting Israeli developments in technology and agriculture. Following a speech, he'll have dinner with Israeli President Shimon Peres, then the next day meet again with Netanyahu before seeing an Iron Dome battery and meeting the soldiers who work on it. And then he goes on to Jordan. Sounds busy. More news from Israel and the Kotel, the Western Wall, holiest site in the world for Jews. Last week, for the first time in the 24 years that the women of the Wall have celebrated Rosh Chodesh, the new month at Jerusalem's Kotel, they were allowed to pray undisturbed, at least for a while. This was thanks to the presence of four IDF paratroopers who liberated the Western Wall during the Six-Day War on June 7, 1967. In addition to these IDF veterans, the women were joined by dozens of male supporters who prayed from the other side of the separation barrier between the men's and women's side. But sadly, that wasn't the end of the story. After completing the service for the new month of Adar at the Kotel, Anat Hoffman, executive director of the Israel Religious Action Center and chair of Women of the Wall and a past guest of Two Jewish, embraced one of the Six-Day War heroes, quoting the late commander of the paratroopers, Mota Gur, saying, "Har Habayit Biyadenu, the Temple Mount, is in our hands." Afterwards, the paratroopers, known in Jerusalem as the liberators of the old city, departed. And the police moved in and arrested some of the women. Barbara Kavadius, the acting executive director of ARTSA, the Association of Reform Zionists of America, who was at the service, said, "The police peeled them away in such a way that we did not even see it happen. We discovered the women were gone when we went to Robinson's Arch to read from the Torah." Among those arrested were Anat Hoffman, Reform Rabbi Susan Silverman, the sister of comedian Sarah Silverman, and her teenage daughter Hallel, who both live in Jerusalem, Lior Nivo, a pregnant HUC rabbinical student, Leslie Sachs, Women of the Wall director, and others. They were taken to the Kisla police station near the Jaffa Gate in the Armenian quarter of Jerusalem. When told of the arrest, Jewish Agency Chairman Natan Sharansky responded angrily and called on Jerusalem's police chief, Yossi Pariente, to release the arrested women. Last month, Sharansky was asked by Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to recommend a solution about prayer at the Kotel, and he had contacted Pariente last week in advance of Rosh Chodesh, asking that the police refrain from unnecessary interference and only assign woman officers to the service. Didn't happen that way.
Start spreading the news. I am leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
In a follow-up story to the death of former New York Mayor Ed Koch, a news anchor on Fox TV in the Big Apple had an unfortunate slip-up announcing his memorial service.
The mayor, the governor, former President Clinton, and hundreds of others gathered to say goodbye to the man who was the face of New York for more than a decade.
Let's get to Fox News' Linda Schmidt, who's live at Gracie Mansion tonight, where the family will be sitting Shiva tomorrow, Linda.
Well, Ed Koch was a plain-spoken man of the people, right? And in more serious news, Rabbi David Hartman, one of the most interesting and courageous Orthodox thinkers and philosophers of the 20th century and a great pioneer in creating opportunities for Orthodox rabbis and thinkers to explore flexibility and modernity, and Reform and conservative rabbis and thinkers to explore the depth of tradition, David Hartman has died at the age of 81. His mentor may have been the Rav, the great modern Orthodox leader and thinker Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. But his Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem serves a magnificent mission, enriching the education, commitment, and inspiration of Jewish leaders of all dispositions today. May his memory continue to be a blessing. Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back our guest this morning, Professor Eric Myers of Duke University, one of the most distinguished biblical archaeologists in the world. We were just talking about Sepphoris Tzipori, a site with which he is uniquely identified. He also has a new book out, which is Alexander to Constantine, Archaeology of the Land of Israel, Volume 3. Kind of an important period in that volume, but let's talk just a little bit more about Tzipori. There are some amazing, quite beautiful Byzantine-era mosaics in Tzipori. And they are, besides being beautiful, images of not only human faces, but human faces associated with Greek cultic experience, the Dionysian cult in particular. If these mansions were actually the homes of distinguished Jews of the period, including perhaps Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, you know, the guy who codifies the Mishnah, what does that say about many of the Jewish rules about not having images, about not allowing other gods that are worshipped into their own homes, even in the synagogue? It seems really kind of extraordinary.
Well, Rabbi Yehuda's obviously tolerant of all of this material. The House of Dionysus with the gorgeous mosaic of the Mona Lisa and the scenes from the mythology of the drinking bout between Heracles and Dionysus, and with only Greek labels on the floor.
Yeah, no Hebrew at all. Nothing. No Arabic, nothing.
No Hebrew whatsoever. Suggests that the rabbis and Rabbi Judah the Patriarch was very comfortable, was completely at home in the Greco-Roman world. Indeed, the Talmud talks about Rabbi Judah's legendary friendship with Emperor Caracalla, the emperor of the Roman Empire. So we have the distinct feeling, and now the proof in the facts on the ground, that the Jewish leadership, just 100 and some years after the Second War with Rome, was completely at home with that Roman world in which art, images, Greek mythology were part and parcel of everyday life. And that's very significant. So one of the themes of this new book that I wrote with my colleague from SMU, Mark Chancy, is that acculturation, accommodation to the dominant cultural ambiance of the day, was part and parcel, if not the key, to survival of the Jewish people, not only in the Greco-Roman period, but I would suggest in all periods.
The which has actually some interesting implications for people living today. You know, how distinct do we need to be from the culture around us? It's still an ongoing discussion for Jews, some of whom consider assimilation, you know, a terrible sin, others whom see is the essential nature of Judaism, the evolutionary quality of Judaism over the years. You couldn't be writing about a more important period archaeologically than the time between Alexander and Constantine. Tell us about the most important aspects of the archaeology and sort of how this book helps to illuminate that period. That huge, I should say, period also.
Well, we take the reader by the hand from the very moment that Constantine conquers the Levant and comes into Jerusalem, 332 BCE, right up until...
Well, Alexander conquers the Levant and comes in, yes. 332 BCE.
Yes. Okay. All the way till the time that Constantine, emperor of the East, converts to Christianity and makes Christianity the imperial religion.
So after the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, and there we are. Okay.
Exactly. So we take them site by site and integrate this together with all of the literary sources of the day and try to show that the increasing accommodation of the people of Israel in this late period, the Jewish people in the Greco-Roman period, led to one of the most creative epochs in the history of the Jewish people. It led to the creation of Christianity, which was a Jewish form of expression in the first century. And the particular dialogue with that new group that followed Jesus, first in Judea and then in other areas of the country, is very key moment in the book. And we go through all of the new evidence, the James ossuary and the Jesus family and Jesus DNA and his so-called non-resurrection that some people now claim. We go through all of that evidence, and one of the most remarkable things to come out of it is that the material culture of early Christianity in the land before Constantine is identical with that of the Jewish people. It's no surprise to me, but when we put it out there for all to see, I think it's one of the most important features of the book that we deal with. They used special stone vessels for purity that are mentioned in the Gospel of John in chapter 2 in the wedding of Cana. They use the same lamps to illuminate their homes that all Jews used at the time. They practice ritual immersion in mikvaot like all Jews of the time. So and their everyday life was identical to the Jewish people. So there's no hint at any major difference. Now, in a couple of sites, we begin to see the story of Christianity emerge. We see it, for example, in the House of Peter at Capernaum, where we have some graffiti, and we have perhaps a house church opposite a synagogue. And by that time of Constantine the Great, what do we have? We have a big synagogue and a big church facing one another in a small, tiny village on the Sea of Galilee, which suggests that the story of Jewish-Christian relations in the land was not so terrible as a lot of books have repeatedly claimed through the centuries.
So with that in mind, because having been to many of these sites, you know, it's incontrovertible. You know, they're clearly doing things just like the Jews. There just seem to be, it almost seems, as Christianity was often called, you know, another sect of Judaism. The bifurcation from the time of Constantine on, which I know goes beyond the scope of your book, is shocking in many ways coming out of this? Or is it a logical step when you draw that line? Because obviously there's lots of anti-Jewish legislation that begins to come in when you get to the Theodosian Code, other codes. You know, there's lots of terrible things that are established for Jews. How does that come out of this, what seems to be a pretty respectful background?
Ironically, the fact that Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the empire, I think had also a positive effect on the emergence of Judaism in late antiquity after Constantine. We have many new synagogues that were built. Disproportionate number of new synagogues, many of them internally, according to the laws that were passed at the time. The mosaics, if anything, get fancier in the Byzantine period. We get more use of the zodiac in Sepphoris and in Tiberias and in other places, including Jericho. And so Judaism enters a period of robust development in the Amoraic and post-Amoraic period of the late rabbis of the Palestinian Talmud. Piyut, Jewish poems, homilies are written. The Midrashim, the homiletic commentaries on the Bible are produced in this period. And what is amazing to me as a historian of the Jewish people and archaeologist, not only is the Bible one of the most unique creations in the history of literature, but if you go into the nitty-gritty of Jewish creativity, you get the Mishnah, you get the Talmud, you get the Piyutim, you get the homilies, the Midrash, all of this while Christianity was beginning to take over the entire Eastern world of the Roman Empire. An enormous period of Jewish creativity in this era.
So it's almost as though Christianity is good for the Jews, at least for a while.
I would agree with that.
Fascinating. In preparing this book, you mentioned the James Ossuary, some fairly recent and highly controversial archaeological finds. Where do you fall on that particular question?
Well, I rang the bell on the James Ossuary controversy back in 2002 already. Its provenance is unknown, possibly part of the inscription forged. A huge deal was made of it in a movie and in a press release. A lot of money was made by people as a result of it. This is not the way important discoveries are announced to the world. They have to go through peer review, serious discussions, and many of the people associated with that discovery and subsequent discoveries like the so-called Talpiot A-B tombs, where Jesus' DNA was found and Jonah ossuary uncovered, also fall under that kind of false archaeology or fake archaeology.
Does that mean, and there was a long case in Israel, the Israel Antiquities Authority, the government prosecuting, and eventually it didn't pan out, or the case anyway was dropped.
The case was not dropped.
I'm sorry, not dropped.
Not dropped. And Mr. Golan was convicted on two major accounts, and the long case that was summed up by the judge made it very clear that he did not consider this an acquittal of any sort. And Golan and many other forgers in Israel are interfering with our right to write history on the basis of scientifically uncovered truths and data. Very unfortunate.
Very unfortunate. Probably has been going on a long time.
Forgery and fakes in the antiquities business is a multi-billion dollar industry, and finally the lawyers are catching up to the industry.
I want to thank Professor Eric Myers for a great visit. His book is called Alexander to Constantine, Archaeology of the Land of Israel, Volume 3, and you can get it just where you always get books, I guess on Amazon.
Yes, and it's also available as an e-book, and it's published by Yale University Press.
Thank you very much, Eric.
Pleasure to be here.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 when our guest will be legendary comedian Robert Klein. And don't forget to get your tickets for the 10th anniversary celebration of Too Jewish at the Fox Theaters Saturday night, March 2nd, with comedian Robert Klein. Go to foxtucsontheater.org or call 520-547-3040 for tickets. It's a great benefit for some wonderful charities. Our playout this morning comes from the Holiday of Purim, celebrated for many congregations like my own Temple Emmanuel just about now, this Sunday morning, February 17th, right after 2 Jewish at 10 a.m. And, of course, the actual Megillah reading next Saturday night and Sunday, March 23rd and 24th. This final playout is a Sephardic Purim tune and Besar Akonar from the wonderful group The Voice of the Turtle and their album The Sword of the Dove, a whole CD of Sephardic Purim tunes. My friends, have a Chag Purim Sameach, a happy holiday of Purim, and may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.